Colleagues, welcome to CSIS. My name is Heather Conley. I'm the director of the Europe program here, and we have a great treat in front of us today. I actually think talking about the Arctic in the summertime is the absolutely right thing. We have to keep our thoughts cool as the heat and humidity around us converges. We should actually, I'm very grateful to Secretary Kerry, because the State Department is hosting today and tomorrow a very big conference on oceans policy. And this is what has brought Jan Gunnar Winter to Washington. And we are so privileged to be able to steal him away, literally, from the conference for an hour and a half to give you a very dynamic presentation on the changes, the environmental and the climate changes we're seeing in the Arctic, and then what are their regional and global implications. I was privileged over a year ago in Reykjavik to hear Jan Gunnar give a presentation. And for someone who has studied the Arctic for over 5 years, I'm on the Arctic conference circuit. It's some people go to baseball games, I go to conferences, and I can tell you that Jan Gunnar's presentation was one of the very best that I have ever heard. It was also one of the most terrifying, so I'll put that in perspective as how dramatic and profound and stunning these changes are. So without further ado, let me just briefly introduce Jan Gunnar to you. He's going to walk you through this magnificent presentation. And then following, we're going to do some question and answers. There is no question that is a dumb question, or I'm not an expert in climate, I'm not a scientist, but there are only good questions and informed questions, so I want everyone to feel like they can contribute to our dialogue. Jan Gunnar Winter is the director of the Norwegian Polar Institute. He has been in that position since 2005. Previously, he led the Polar Institute's Antarctic section and has been a long-standing research director for the Institute. Has served as a research engineer previous to joining the Polar Institute. So with that, Jan Gunnar, welcome to CSIS. Colleagues, welcome, and welcome to the Arctic. Now, if the air conditioning gets a little high in here, you feel like it's in the Arctic, let us know. We'll turn it down a little bit. So with that, Jan Gunnar, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Heather. Thank you for your nice words. I feel the pressure is on now. I'll try to comply with expectations, and I'll try to be finishing up my presentation in at least less than half an hour, maybe 20, 25, and then we will have questions. I'm very glad that so many of you took the time in late afternoon to come and listen to and discuss the Arctic, because what I hopefully will show in this presentation is that the Arctic, even though it's far away for most of us, it is of importance far out of the region. It has a global aspect, and the climate changes in the Arctic affects us all. This picture is from the area in Svalbard, which is part of the Norwegian Arctic, in summertime. So just to give you a kind of impression of the environment, how it looks up there. I'll start with the global situation, and I will use quite a few figures from the last IPCC report. This is one of them. Here are the decadal average global temperatures shown from 1850 up till today. And as we can see, each of the three last decades has been successively warmer than any preceding decade since 1850. We can see it's been relatively flat in the beginning of the 1900th century, and then it was a warming period in the 30s, flat again, and then it's been increasing. Now, this is not evenly distributed at the planet, and we know also that we have a larger warming in the Arctic, almost double than the global average. So we have confidence now that the warmest 30-year period we had the last 30 years has not been seen in the last 1400 years. This amplification shows up in a diagram like this, where the mean of the temperature for the last century is compared to the last decade. We see the red colors in the Arctic. We see also reddish color up in the high north. And in many areas we have already passed the 2-degree world when it is talking about the Arctic. But also other places around the globe, in Himalayas, and of course we see a red spot at the Antarctic Peninsula, where we had a warming of almost 3 degrees Celsius in the last 50 years. And that is approximately 6 times more than the global average, which is about a degree in 100 years. The simple explanation of this is that in the polar regions and the regions of the Earth where we have snow and ice, if you have a warming and you remove that snow and ice and you get open ocean or vegetation instead, you change the energy balance totally from reflecting 80 to 90% of the energy from the sun when we have snow and ice. If that's removed and we have water or vegetation, you absorb around 80 to 90%. And then the effect of the warming will be much greater in the polar regions. Importance for knowing how climate has changed in a natural phase is also found in the polar regions. One of the most famous data series we have from Antarctica, from ice cores. Here we see the CO2 content of an ice core drilled in Antarctica. And we can see that we have high levels every around 100,000 years, and that coincidences with the warm periods, the interglacial, as we have today, and then we have longer ice ages in between. If I plotted the methane curve and the temperature curve on top of this, they will follow each other almost identically. We are now up 40% from what we can call a natural situation the last almost 1 million year. And this is a statement from IPCC. That the carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide has increased to levels unprecedented in at least the last 800,000 years. So, we know that we had a warming, and very often we think of that warming being expressed in the atmosphere. I'm now not talking to a group of experts that I have in this room, but the general public. However, the energy that we think has come into our system in recent years has gone mostly into the ocean. This is another statement from IPCC. More than 90% of the energy absorbed at the planet has gone into the oceans. And we see here distinguished between the upper ocean, which is the upper 700 meters, and the deep oceans. And we have, of course, a lot of deep oceans around the planet. But further down, we have also energy absorbed in the ice masses, the glaciers around the world, and on land. And then a very tiny pink layer at the very bottom is the atmosphere, because the capacity to store energy is so much greater in the oceans than in the atmosphere. So the oceans has acted as a buffer for the recent input of energy. This is just to show you how we can measure solar radiation below sea ice in the Arctic, where we have cruises and instrumentation. This figure may be familiar to you. It was in Washington Post earlier this year. As climate scientists, we very often are met with discussions around weather versus climate. And the Washington Post, during the very cold period, especially at the east coast of the United States this winter, had this figure showing that we have a probability for a weather event or a climate development where the most likely, let's say, summer temperature in Washington at a certain climate will be this at the top of the histogram. However, we can always have the extremes, the extreme cold or hot. What we are doing now by increasing the global temperature is that we are shifting this probability curve or histogram towards the right. So we will still have cold winters, but they will not be as cold as they used to be. We will have warm extreme events, but they will be even more extreme than in the past. And this figure was then followed by this one during this very cold outbreak of polar air hitting the East Coast, showing winter temperatures over the United States. And I mean, this is the climate. December, January, February, over 40 years, showing that on average, US had a winter increase in temperature of 0.61 degrees per decade, which is over this period almost 2.5 degrees. So that's the climate change that has been here. And then we had a weather event, which I will address a little bit later. We can actually expect to get more of them. And I'll explain why later. So leaving now the non-Arctic and more the global arena and heading to the north. Here are four photos almost taken over the same area, starting in 1922. I'm not the one sitting on the 1939 picture. However, I started my work and I did my PhD up here in the late 80s. And it's not a problem for me to see how the landscape has changed over these years. You see that the glaciers that are coming out here are gone, more or less. You see some here in the later photos. The sea ice doesn't form in the fjords anymore. The glaciers are retreating backwards. Also the ones that are standing out in the ocean, and that is quite a dramatic change that is visible in this area. This was an example of what we call often small glaciers in glaciology. There are two giants in the world. One is Greenland. Greenland is about between 15 and 20 times larger in volume than all other glaciers except Antarctica around the world. So if you take North and South America, Himalaya, Iceland, the Arctic, they constitute around 0.5% of the land ice we have on Earth. And in Greenland, we find about 8. And what's left then? Well, more than 90%, and that's hidden or stored in Antarctica. Now, the worrying part is that Greenland has started to lose mass. There are two main reasons for that. One is that we have an increased melting at the surface during summer, which produces meltwater that drains down through cracks and crevasses and goes all the way through glaciers and lubricates the surface between the glacier and the rock that it rests on, making it move faster. The other one is that the ocean temperature has increased and glaciers that are standing out in the ocean are surrounded by warmer water, and that is also one important explanation for this increased mass loss. In Antarctica, things are quite different. It's a continent covered by ice, in average 2,000 meters thick. More or less all of Antarctica, the continent, is surrounded by ice shelves, floating ice, so where the inland ice meets the ocean. And the ice shelves, they constitute around the same mass as Greenland. They are standing out in the ocean like shown here, and further to the north, it's relatively warm water. It's not warm, but it's relatively warm. And now there are indications, at least in certain parts of Antarctica, that due to changes in atmospheric circulation and changes in ocean circulations, this relatively warm water gets more effectively in contact with these ice shelves. And this is also the reason why at the Antarctic Peninsula we have had ice shelves that had collapsed. And if you remove such an ice shelf, then it will make the ice that is further upstream move faster to the ocean. So it gets kind of a domino effect. While you take away the mass represented by the ice shelf, the ice that is upstream is then flowing faster to the ocean and producing icebergs. So IPCC, in its last report from last year, makes some estimates of our current knowledge. And while we, around 1990 and even in 2000, made statements in IPCC that the world's glacier, except Greenland and Antarctica, was the most prominent one when it came to sea level rise, this is not longer the case. If you have Greenland and Antarctica combined, they are now adding more to global sea level than the rest of the world's glacier. And we can see that at the very right hand of this diagram that Greenland and Antarctica have a upwards turning curve here. So this will not be evenly, this global sea level rise will not be evenly distributed around the world. There are ocean and atmospheric circulation patterns that will make an uneven distribution of that. But the point is that, and an important one, is that these large ice masses like Greenland and Antarctica, they need more than 10 and 100, they even more than 1,000 years to stabilize at a certain climate surrounding them. So if you turn on the heat with 2 degrees, it takes 1,000 years before Antarctica is finished with this response to that climate change. So when we look at, okay, let me see what happened now. When we look I think I removed one too much here. I wanted to make it shorter. When we look at the IPCC projections for sea level rise this century, it's of course dependent on what emission scenarios we will follow. But let's say above 0.5 meter is the most likely sea level rise globally that we must expect. This will be different if we look in 2300, because Greenland and Antarctica are not finished with their response to the climate change. Okay, I'm leaving the glaciers and the global sea level. I'm turning to the sea ice and now in the Arctic. Here is the absolute minimum as we know it from September 2012. We see an open Northwest Passage and then Northern Sea Route also open. And we have fairly good data back in time here, 1450 years, showing that the summer sea ice in the Arctic has been around 10 million square kilometers, and then we had a drop in the latest years. And if we zoom in on 1979 up till last year, this is how the September coverage of sea ice was in the Arctic Ocean. All years since 2005 have a lower extent than the previous years, all the previous years. We see that it goes up and down between years, but the tendency is quite strong in the longer term, but also more lately that we have a loss of summer sea ice. And if you plot it in this way, showing all the months of the year, we see that the winter months also have a decline when it comes to coverage, but it's much less than in summer. The black curve in the middle is the September one. While we see the winter months in the outside of this tree ring diagram. In 2007, which was the second last IPCC report, this figure was used. All the black and gray curves show climate models starting in 1900, going all the way to 2100, simulating sea ice coverage in summer in the Arctic Ocean. The red curve is what is actually happening. So this is based on the satellite data I showed in the previous one. So we could then see that models did not do their job. And then we came to 2012, and I did just this for kind of as an example. In 2012, we had 3.4 million square kilometers sea ice coverage in the Arctic Ocean. If you use the average of all climate models back in 2007, they show this will happen in 2070, not in 2012. That is a significant mismatch between models and reality. Now, these models have been improved somewhat, but they are still not of high precision and good enough quality. Imagine that we are like this diver in the ocean space for a moment, and we are back in 1980 when the sea coverage in the Arctic Ocean was more or less complete during also summer. Then we had a sea ice like we have the ceiling here that was unbroken. Today it looks like this. It's a mosaic of open water and sea ice. And in 2012, when we had this minimum, it was also weather events that influenced on the sea ice melt, because storm patterns and storm events came into the Arctic Ocean. And what happens if you have a hole in the ceiling and it's blowing outside? Well, you get energy into the water, into this space. And that was exactly what happened. And then you get a more efficient melting of the sea ice. This animation shows how ice is moving in the Arctic Ocean. The whiter the colors, the older and thicker the ice. And we see that every winter, more or less, the whole Arctic Ocean freezes back. And we see the blue color. But what we also will see here is that we get less and less of the multi-year ice. And today we have probably around 15% of sea ice older than 2 years. And the multi-year ice that was typical in the 1980s and 1990s has to a large extent disappeared. Also, due to the drift that goes from east to west from Russia, Siberia, over towards Greenland and the Canadian and US Arctic, the thick ice is collected along the coast of Greenland, Canada, and Alaska, while there is more or less no thick multi-year ice left outside the Russian coast. And this is also important for a topic that I don't have time to dive into now, and that is shipping. There is a different story if you go in first-year ice compared to multi-year ice. It's not only the thickness, it's also the properties of the ice. So if you then look at IPCC's projections for the sea ice in summer, there are different emission scenarios here, but it is a medium confidence that we before mid-century have a nearly ice-free Arctic Ocean defined by 1 million square kilometers. Yeah, a few words about shipping, and maybe that will be in the questions too. Of course, this change, this opens up for different activities, fisheries, oil and gas, tourism, but shipping is one of them. And I wanted to make you aware of one thing. Very often these satellite products, like I have shown, I show here, are used to show where we have ice at a certain time in the Arctic. But there is one very important story behind this product. And when it was made in 79 for producing these maps, it was the intention to have a product that distinguished between open water and sea ice. So the mathematical algorithm here is such that in each pixel that shows up as white here, it's at least 15%, 1/5 sea ice. It could be up to 85% open water, and just the way that the algorithm is made. So we should not think of this as fully covered by ice. So the future might be that with intelligent maneuvering, as I call it, when you have information on the bridge, on ships, you can get the real situation ahead of you, and you can make a zigzagging or intelligent maneuvering also through this white area, not only where we have open sea. Now turning to the ecosystem, briefly, my time is running out. This is one of my favorite schematics. It's not mine. It's the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment, which is a kind of a regional IPCC that came out exactly 10 years ago, showing possible changes in the fish distribution in the Atlantic sector. And this has happened now in reality, and much more than here was illustrated that could happen within this century. We have had, for example, the mackerel along the Norwegian coast that you can see here is now found all the way up in the Arctic. We have had a migration of whales, of birds, seals, polar bear. I could continue. And this has happened very rapidly and quite unexpected. And then if you look at the marine environment and the marine ecosystem in the context of food production, which has also been part of the Ocean Conference now, it's quite interesting, this figure, I think. Some of you know this, so you can't answer me, but nobody has even been close when I asked the question, how large percentage do we today produce food from land? So how much are we producing from land? Is there anyone that dares to give it a try? It's much higher than people think. It's 98%. Only 2% is out from the oceans, covering more than 70% of the surface of the globe. And this figure shows that it will be worse and worse conditions in many regions of the world for food production from land. And when it comes to the northern waters, in particular, the biomass in the marine ecosystem will increase in a warming scenario, and that is because there are cold waters there, and an increase is in a way good for the biomass production in the northern waters. We have a greening round in the Arctic. It's more trees coming, bush replacing lichen and moss. The tree line is climbing up. It's also migrating northwards, large changes also on land, and I rather take that in the question round than going into that now. This is my second last, just to put some of the issues at stake in the Arctic. There are many, and this institution works with security and international questions, but my kind of statement would be that very much of the issues that we see here on the graph are finally and tightly connected to climate change. And you can't disregard climate change in any of these other words here. So that is very important to have that knowledge. And that brings me to an end. Sorry for using more than 20 minutes, but...
Thank you so much. I told you it would be terrifying. Thank you so much. It's a great overview, and really looking forward to getting into some questions. And what I'll do is I'll sort of warm you up a little bit. I'll throw some questions out to Jan Gunnar and then open the floor for discussion and comment. I'm wondering, it wasn't on your slide presentation, but I'd like to talk a little bit about permafrost thaw. And that, and the implications for that. We know, and I think always the difference between the Arctic and the Antarctic, 4 million people live in the Arctic. There is infrastructure there, and the thawing of the permafrost is sinking pipelines, buildings, infrastructure, architecture, but there's also a potential of massive methane release, as I understand it, carbon emissions, greenhouse emissions from permafrost thaw. How big of an issue is that for, it's not the ocean, but the surrounding land in the permafrost areas?
Well, it's a big issue because it's still a lot of unknowns connected to that issue. We know for sure that we have more greenhouse gases naturally stored in frozen soil, carbon dioxide, but also methane, that what we have emitted from anthropogenic activity. So there is a huge storage there. And we know also that the temperature has increased in the permafrost, especially in Siberia, also in North America, up to between 2 and 3 degrees several places. So we have a thawing of the permafrost. However, this is not going to be immediately released to the atmosphere because this is thawing slowly, and we have many places where we have up to a kilometer and at least many hundred meters of permafrost thickness, and that will not change or disappear in short time. The one area that is sometimes forgotten is the offshore permafrost, and maybe that seems like a paradox, but we still have continental shelf areas surrounding the Arctic from last ice age that is frozen. And with a warming ocean, We have now an ocean surrounding this continental shelf with higher temperature. And we know from the past, from the way past, that we can have offshore or subsea slides. And if that should happen, then you would expose much more immediately larger areas that can release immediate methane and carbon dioxide. So in the kind of dramatic fashion, the offshore is the most important, and there are lots of gaps in knowledge on that. And on land, it will happen surely, but quite slowly.
Jan Gunnar, have we reached the tipping point? I mean, that's often reflected in a media discourse where you've already said that we've already reached above 3% in some area in the polar regions. Is at this point this reversible, even if we were to have a massive global effort to slow it down? Or has it reached a point where the warming ocean, the less reflection, has a life of its own that we're not going to be able to stop?
Yeah, that is not a yes-no question.
Not an easy one either.
No, because if we go carbon negative, and IPCC, some of these scenarios that I didn't go into detail, they show that we are able to stabilize temperature. We are able to kind of level off the extent of sea ice in the Arctic. If you have an ambitious cut and reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. But some of the changes that we have already introduced by raising the temperature will take very long, and the ice sheets are the best example of that, because we have already committed these ice shelves to release water to the oceans for a long time. If we are not kind of cooling down the planet. So let's see, we are leveling off the temperature increase at 2 degrees Celsius, which is very ambitious. We will still have an effect from the ice sheets that will go on for hundreds of years ahead. So in that sense, we have reached a tipping point. When it comes to the sea ice in the Arctic, there are also many voices saying that we already have past the tipping point, in the sense that we have now a first year sea ice regime. Not totally, but in Antarctica we know that we have more first year ice, very little multi-year ice. And then we see things in the ecosystem, especially the marine ecosystem, that is very rapidly changing. And I don't think I would even try to answer if that is a tipping point or not. For some species, it might. The polar bear is a very symbolic species, of course, and if the sea ice would disappear in summer, which is not unlikely, the polar bear will have hard times as a polar bear. Evolutionarily, he will probably, and she will go on land and continue to live there, but not as the polar bear we know it. So it's a yes for some aspects, and it's maybe not or not for others. Sorry for not being more kind of definite, but I think that's fair to make that nuances.
You mentioned to me before we started that part of tomorrow's discussion at the State Department Oceans Conference is on ocean acidification. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the impact of ocean acidification on the Arctic specifically.
Yeah. So we have a reduction of the pH due to the absorption of the CO2 gas into the ocean that lowers the pH and makes it more acid. It's still not acid, the ocean, but that is important, especially for the organisms that have carbonite, and that is coral reefs, and it's some shellfish, and there are also mussels and others that have a protecting carbonite by nature, and that can be then attacked by a more acid ocean. The Arctic, with its cold water, dissolves CO2 more efficiently than warm water. So as in very many other cases, also ocean acidification is in a way especially relevant for the cold waters, the cold areas of the planet. It dissolves more efficiently. But we know that the acidification, the rate of it, is very different from what we have had probably millions of years in the past. But the full effect of it is still not known.
And my last question, so I can unleash our colleagues to you. Can you talk a little bit about coastal erosion? You mentioned about storm severity. And we're seeing, and certainly Alaska and others, because the sea ice is diminishing, it's not providing that buffer. As the severity of the storms come in, we're really seeing where indigenous villages are having to be moved from the coast because of erosion. How significant of an issue is that for the Arctic, and is it location specific, or is it all over circumpolar? I mean, is it more acutely felt in Russia, or is it more where the sea ice is so rapidly diminished, or would the other side of the Arctic, the Canadian and Alaskan side, feel it the most?
Yeah. So the reason why we have a coastal erosion is maybe threefold. It's the thawing permafrost, which kind of weakens the stability on along the coastline, and it's the lack of sea ice or less sea ice that doesn't protect the shoreline, as you said, and also severity of storms, or more effectively impact from storms due to the lack of sea ice. So we have a coastal erosion all around the Arctic. Some places it's up to 10 meters a year. This is from Russia. We see it in Svalbard, in the Norwegian part of the Arctic. It's of course having a local impact, but many of the locally established infrastructure is close to the ocean, because that gives you an easy access to the ocean. So it will affect locally, but that wouldn't be my greatest concern, though. From what's going on in the Arctic, I would be more concerned about what I didn't talk so much about, is that this change in the Arctic seems to have also a pronounced effect on weather and climate outside the Arctic. I talked about global sea level, that's one example, but also the changes in the Arctic, the atmospheric circulation, and partly the ocean circulation, seem, and this is early days of relatively new science, that we can have effects that goes way outside the region. I mentioned this cold outbreak here at the east coast of United States. That was one example where we think, due to the warming of the Arctic, less temperature gradients between the Arctic and lower latitudes, that we weaken the polar vortex or the circumarctic circulation that in the past protected the Arctic from warm air coming up to the Arctic, but it also protected the lower latitudes from having cold air coming to the south. And if that vortex is weakening, then we can, in a warming Arctic, in a warming globe, have more of these cold weather events that hit you in this winter. It hit Europe the winter before with the frozen over Donau. And severe snowstorms, and in China they had also that 2 years ago. So this changes. Another indication of a changing pattern in the Arctic that can affect other areas is that we know that the latest years there has been some changes in the location of the high and low pressure systems. They are not identically where they used to be in the past. And there was, which was a rare event, a high pressure system over the southern tip of Greenland during Sandy. That was important for where Sandy hit, because this high pressure system was kind of pushing the atmospheric circulation towards the east coast of the United States. But to say that we have sure evidence for that kind of be happening, that's too early to say. But also in the last IPCC report, there are many papers taken into discussion about how the Arctic climate can affect the monsoon. So this is, there are many scientific works that give an indication of these kind of changes in the teleconnection between the Arctic and other parts of the world, especially the Northern Hemisphere.
Fantastic. All right, I've given you plenty of time to collect your tough questions for Jan Gunnar. So please, if you could just raise your hand and identify yourself, your name and your affiliation, and we will let the questions begin. Oliver.
Oliver Beckus. I work here down the hall from Heather with the Russia Eurasia program. I was taken aback by the chart you showed of the sort of increases in food production as a result of temperature increases. And in particular, the fact that basically all of Russia was covered by either 50% or 100% increases over whatever period it was. And I'm wondering, and with the decreases coming, you know, in the sort of southern hemisphere, and I'm wondering, is that a trend that the data suggests will be repeated in other industries beyond just agriculture? Do increases in temperature increase productivity of workers in colder areas? Does it increase the ability to get energy, hydrocarbons out of the ground? Do you see that having any kind of impact on the economic potential of sort of colder areas, in particular in a country like Russia?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I'm the right person to answer that, but I'll give it a try. And since you refer to this view graph, I'll explain it a bit more in detail. So this is model changes in food production over land areas, only land areas, in 2050 compared to 2000. And here we have projections. I mean, there is some emission scenarios in here and some projections for how temperature will develop. It's not very surprising that the already hot areas of the world will have a tougher situation for agriculture, but there is a clear correlation which is not shown on this figure with availability of water or the lack of water, and in Africa and Australia and parts of Asia and South America in particular, but also in the southern part of United States. Now, so when you go to the northern areas, including Russia, as you pointed to, and Scandinavia, this warming will be followed in most places, in most seasons. This is, of course, also varying with more precipitation and more water, and which makes it also not only warmer, but also more water that is positive for production. But I don't think I will go further to, I mean, efficiency of workers, that's what you asked about. I think this, I don't think I'm the right person to answer that, but such a figure like this, given that it will happen, like it is shown here, is certainly, you could start thinking of if this will not lead to migration of people. That's certainly one thing you could look into this figure and think how that will affect where people live in the future. And my point then was another one, and it was if we have to turn to the oceans to for our food production, which I also think is a very likely development, and not only on the traditional species and fish that we use today, but also seaweed and other biomass from the oceans.
Jan Gunnar, one could argue that the Northern Sea Route and potentially the Northwest Passage become more interesting should you see the food production shift so far north and having to take that supply routes and to be able to export potentially those food products globally could also strengthen the transportation justification for the Arctic as well.
If you allow me, I can say a few things about shipping or transportation, marine one in the Arctic. If you go to conferences where this is discussed, there is a large variation in views on how the future will develop, from very conservative ones to very liberal or optimistic ones. And my observation as a non-expert on this, is that on other areas, the difference between the outliers in view is much smaller. And that tells me that we need to have an open mind for how this can develop. Having a natural sciences background, I think we have already passed the point or the tipping point where the sea ice for up to half of the year already is not the bottleneck anymore. There are very many other bottlenecks in this area. It's not mapped very well. It's poor communication, not broadband most places. Search and rescue, insurance companies. You have to have some ice class on your ships, even though the Russians lifted that last year between August and October. You need escortation and so on and so on. So it's still a series of bottlenecks, but the one bottleneck from the past that was number one and the absolute one is kind of disappearing gradually. There is also one interesting thing to see here on this map is how different the Northwest Passage is from the Northeast Passage. So the port of the Kara port, that is the beginning of the Northeast Passage, is already skipped by most of the transits today. They are going north of Novaya Zemlya up here because there is almost no ice west of Novaya Zemlya all year round. But when you get east of Novaya Zemlya, there is more ice. But what you can see easily is that there are only a few shallow and narrow parts in the Northeast Passage compared to a much more complex Northwest Passage. And I think I told Heather when we met 2 weeks ago that I was attending a Arctic shipping meeting in London that was organized by The Economist earlier this winter, where it was stated in very clearly in a panel that if you wanted to sail through a passage, it doesn't matter if it's open water, 1,000 kilometers, if you have blocked your route in one place. And that was stated based on the experience from the Northwest Passage. And that's very true with the Northwest Passage as it is from nature. However, along the coast of Russia, there are only a few places where you can be blocked. And at these places, at least given the ice situation as we see here, you can avoid them by sailing a alternative route. So in the summer of 2013, these narrow passages along the Northern Sea Route, they were blocked with ice into June, while it was open water north of these passages. So it opened up for sailing earlier to the north than along the coast because of this narrow parts.
Colleagues, any questions? Yes, ma'am, please.
My name is Martha Pasalia. I'm an environmental studies student from Drew University in New Jersey. My question isn't a science question, but maybe you have some insight. I was curious, is there any international discussion about relocating Inuit or cultural preservation and helping them out?
Not really. So if somebody else in the room would like to answer that, that would be great. I don't think I will enter that. Yes, there is one.
Sorry about this. Coming around. Or just, grab one of those. Thank My name is Krisha Pohl. I'm with the office of Senator Cantwell. But in response to your question, what little I know about the tribes up there, that they're doing their best to sort of shelter in place. And I think that the U.S. government is kind of caught in a box of how to help these peoples because of Alaska sort of tribal rules and the, and rules and regulations and tribal laws to U.S. tribal laws to help them. But the Army Corps has been specifically with the Inuits on in Shishmaref. They've been trying to basically build up the build up barriers to protect from coastal erosion. But, you know, the money's just not flowing quickly or at all. I wish I could remember the names of the acts, but that's what I know as far as trying to do their, you know, protect, keep the people there. But the infrastructure is so, there's just so little infrastructure, and it would cost upwards of billions of dollars to do what they would really need. That's what I know.
I just know anecdotally, because of some of the coastal erosion, where some of the smaller villages are right next to the sea, they've had to move them back. The other changes in having to have some population movements is because of food security, that the hunting patterns are changing, and they've had to shift and rethink that. But that's only anecdotal knowledge to accent. Thank you for helping us out.
Yeah, in Norway, the issue with the indigenous people is connected, and climate change is connected mostly to reindeer herding. And I show this photo. It's further south in Norway, but the change in vegetation in the northern part of Norway is going to be a real challenge for the reindeer herders in the future, even at a level where maybe it will not be possible to have that traditional herding anymore. But it's not kind of connected to coastal erosion and moving, but maybe changing the way of life and lifestyle.
Jan-Gunnar, I wonder if you can help us think about black carbon, again, as an accelerant to the warming, and the sources of black carbon. This is the, for lack of better scientific terms, the soot that is on the snow and ice that it enhances the absorptive capacity of the energy. The Arctic Council and others have been focusing on the challenge of black carbon for some time. I wonder if you could offer some reflections, and then I'll turn to you.
Yeah. Well, you already said it. The emissions of black carbon or soot is finding its way all the way to the Arctic. And not visible for eye, it's still reducing the albedo or the efficiency of reflecting solar radiation. A little, but over large areas, that is important for a change in energy balance and also the pace of melting of snow and ice. Now the black carbon and reduction of that, especially from other parts around the world, will also be a positive effect on the health. So it has both a health and a climate side to it, which is important, and both would be positive. The Arctic Council has a task force on black carbon or short-lived climate forces, and that is handled in one of the groups in the Arctic Council.
What's the origins? I've heard it's from dust, that wind patterns change. I've heard it's from gas flaring, overflights. What is the source of black carbon?
From burning of organic material or forests, it's also from diesel engines, and from the coal. I mean, in Asia, in particular, they use coal for also home household warming, heating, and cooking.
Yes, so you had a question, just use the microphone here.
Thank you very much, Doctor. I'm Bert Wong from China's Guangming Daily. You know, some media and scholars has been expressing the concerns about China's increasing activity in Arctic, especially in the mining, in the, you know, shipping lines, and also oil and gas. So what's your perspective on that? My second question is related to the governance of Arctic. What do you think of the most urgent rules or norms should be made for governing the Arctic? How to, what would be the China's take on that? Thank you very much.
Could you please repeat the last part of your question?
No, I mean the most urgent rules and the norms should be made, yeah, regarding the governance of Arctic.
Rules and norms on Arctic.
Yeah, and what could be China's role there? Thank you very much.
Well, as you know, there has been new observers taken up in the Arctic Council last year at the ministerial meeting in Sweden, in Kiruna. Arctic Council is a consensus body or council, and there were seven new nations that were taken up. It's seen as a positive thing that we have now more actors, nations around the Arctic table. In Kiruna, it was China, India, South Korea, Japan, Italy, and not EU at that time, that were taken up as observers. Which means that we are now around the Arctic table, within the Arctic Council, around 60% of the world's population. And having that, let's say, great global coverage of nations that take an interest in the Arctic issues within the framework of the Arctic Council is seen as positive from the eight Arctic states that are full members of the Arctic Council. So, yes, in media there are many things going on and many things discussed, but if you look from the Arctic Council perspective, this has been a positive and development. The most pressing issues, I think, is to balance the activities in the Arctic so we can have a sustainable development. I know that sounds gray and very formally correct, but there are many drivers to the Arctic within economy, geopolitical drivers, and also environmental issues. And we see now a region of the world with, well, you can call it even dramatic, in historical perspective, dramatic changes. We don't know what that will mean in all aspects, but we need to handle this in a very healthy and sustainable way. Maybe it's a bit, what do we say in English? I use a Norwegian example, but forgive me, please, that I'm using a Norwegian example. We have something called the Integrated Management Plan for the Barents Sea and the area in the Norwegian part of the Arctic. And that is built up in such a way that we see, we take sector by sector, fishery sector, oil and gas sector, climate change issues, transportation, tourism, and then we assess the situation, the status, and also the development within these sectors. And then there is made a management of it where all these sectors are balanced against each other. And so it's a, we call it the integrated management plan. And that means that for this area that I'm now talking about, there is a colorful map showing where we have a preference for fisheries, where we have a preference for oil and gas activity, maybe only on parts of the year, where we have a preference for no activity for the environmental matters. And so it's a practical, balanced, integrated, overarching way of managing this ocean. so it can have a sustainable development. I think we need to be careful with the Arctic because it's so sensitive and vulnerable. My vision would be that through the Arctic Council, foremost, the Arctic is used as an example, a showroom, if you wish, for ambitious climate initiatives and projects. Maybe we, and hopefully we can see that under the US chairmanship that starts next year, where the Arctic, because it's so important also for the rest of the world, where we can have ambitious, for example, agreements on climate change issues. It could be reduction of black carbon or methane, or it could be a transition from heavy fuel to lighter fuel products. I mean, these are just examples, but where we show the world, using the Arctic as a showroom, that it can work. And if it can work for the Arctic, maybe it could be exported to the global scene. If the Arctic, with all its speciality, can be used for these kind of purposes for the best for mankind, that would be a very nice thought. That's my personal opinion.
It's a great question. I'm just following up on that, Jan Gunnar. Could you speak a little bit about what does the international science collaboration look like, particularly in the Arctic? Obviously, it's on both Antarctica and Arctic and the Arctic. But we do have, there's a Chinese scientific presence, Svalbard. There's also, I believe, a new science center in northern Iceland. So certainly a lot of international scientific and research activity is going on. Just if you can give us sort of paint a picture a bit of what the international collaboration looks like.
Well, the scientific collaboration, well, both poles, but I can use the Arctic as an example, is very good, and it has been there for a long time. But it has been mostly among the so-called Arctic states that have a neighborhood to the Arctic or are part of the Arctic, which is natural. Now, during the recent decade or so, there has been interest from more countries, for example China, but also others, non-polar states, to work in the Arctic. So there has been more countries which has made the collaboration more wide. But also the Arctic countries, due to the importance of this area, have intensified their activity. So it's the level has gone up and it's been widened in numbers. So in the Norwegian part of the Arctic, we see a lot of interest. China is very often used as an example, but there are many more. Even for South America, we receive interest from establishing some kind of activity in the Arctic. So there are quite a new or many newcomers. Some are big players with icebreakers and stations and so on, and some are smaller players. The last nation that established a station in Svalbard in the Norwegian Arctic is Czechia. That happens this summer.
Dick. Yes. I have a follow-up. Oh, sorry, microphone coming.
I was just curious about what your thoughts are on improving maritime domain awareness up in the Arctic. Do you see that for the U.S.? Do you see the U.S. as needing more infrastructure in the Arctic, more naval presence, more U.S. icebreakers? What are your thoughts on improving awareness?
I will not interfere with U.S. politics, but so if you have an interest in the Arctic and it has an importance, which I think is the case, and that's also the reason why so many also non-Arctic nations are becoming more and more active, and the Arctic nations are enhancing their activity, you need capacity. And in these remote areas and also tough areas to operate in, one of the capacities are ships, vessels. Then I won't say so much more, but I think that US, compared to some other nations, Russia in particular, has less capacity. And I think I stopped there.
Oliver, I think you had a follow-up.
You said earlier that sort of prevailing climate models of, I think it was when we would have an ice-free Arctic and how that process was going to go, were off by approximately 50 or 60 years in 2012. I'm wondering, is the scientific consensus that that was an anomaly, or have they revised the models so that we're going to see an ice-free Arctic much sooner than, you know, 100 years from now?
Well, there is hardly such a thing as a scientific consensus, and you will see different results from different works and groups and so on. And that's the basis of science, which is good. This was an anomaly. I mean, it was the absolute minimum we have observed, and it didn't happen again the year after. We'll have to see what happens this year, but it is part of a development that we have seen the last years. So we must expect conditions like that or even lower in the coming years. Now, there is quite a spread in the models used for projecting when do we get an ice-free Arctic Ocean, and normally defined with 1 million square kilometers, so some ice left, but very little. Some models say it will take a few years only, a handful of years. Others are more at the end of this century. So there is quite a big spread on that. Now, looking back, we have consistently been estimating the pace of this. And we are the scientists and the climate models. That might not be the kind of the right answer for how it will continue, but I just observed that we have underestimated consistently the pace of change in the Arctic, not only on the sea ice, also other things. The ecosystem, marine one, is changing faster than anyone could think of 10 years ago.
Yes, in the back, sir. We just wait for a microphone.
Hello, Mitch Ambrose from the Science and Technology Policy Institute. So my question is directed at the types of science that need to be done in the Arctic. So the National Research Council came out with a report recently, Emerging Questions in the Arctic, basically. And can you speak to what the impacts of the decline in multi-year ice have both on the kind of science that needs done and how science is done in the Arctic? With respect to, does that mean greater demand for in situ measurements versus remote measurements, ice camps, things like that?
Yeah, that's also a very demanding question, because my answer could be very long. But there is I'll try to answer it in a fair and comprehensive way. There is a lack of data observations, especially long-term observations in the Arctic, naturally because it's so remote. So in the past, we haven't had either access or funding or capacity, talking about icebreakers, to have a robust and long-term continuous observation. So it's a general lack of that. And if you then hold that up against now the great need we have to understand more of the Arctic. Yes, we need more in situ measurements, atmosphere, ice, both glaciers and sea ice, oceans, biological data, permafrost. But we also need to improve our climate models, and that is very much connected to the in situ measurements, because we had a lack of the physical understanding of processes. We have not been able to capture these and describe them mathematically in the climate models that is needed to make a good model. And the remote sensing data, satellites, of course, are very helpful. We need to have in-situ measurements to calibrate or verify the satellite observations. New techniques, though, I think also is an area. Drones, ROVs, automatic measurements with new technology, leaving a smaller footprint from the science also in the Arctic. We need to develop and make use of modern high-tech technology also for studying these areas. Was that answering your question? There is a lot to be said about what is needed. I mean, the big, I should take up, let's say, some of the top issues. It's the sea level, which connects to the glaciers. It's the permafrost that we already touched. It is understanding the teleconnections between the Arctic and the rest of the Northern Hemisphere. And I would say the ecosystem changes, how that will affect individual species, but also the whole range of the food chain or the ecosystem. One topic at this ocean conference, which I haven't talked about, which is a very important one also for the Arctic, is pollution. And I'm especially thinking of the plastic part of the pollution. There are some huge figures that are presented, that we have 100 million tons of waste in the ocean. Between 60 and 80% of that is plastic. Out of the plastic, it's 15% that is at the surface of the ocean, 15% at the beaches, which we see. And the most worrying, absolutely, is the 70% that we can't see, which is in the ocean. And very much of that is on a micro scale. So we have now plastic in the microorganisms like plankton, algae, fish. And of course, in this food chain, we are on the top, the humans. And there are examples now that the Arctic is not protected, like for climate change, rather the opposite from what is going on other places in the world. That seems to be, and Kerry was also bringing this up in his opening remarks today, seems to be a fast-growing challenge that we need to handle. It's not the climate change issue, but it's another one. But it affects the health of the oceans, which again will influence also on the health status of food that we will have from the oceans. So when it comes to plastic, we very often see these dramatic photos where we have a net around the neck of a seal or a bird. But when you see that, which is quite painful to see, that's not the real threat. The real threat you can't see.
Jan Gunnar, you made a list of the issues that you follow: the sea level rise, the permafrost, the ecosystem changes. Is there one set that we all have our favorite data, our favorite sort of what we watch? As a scientist, as the director of the Norwegian Polar Institute, is there one set of data that you really follow closely and it tells you, or it speaks to you of some very potential warning signs, or do you just look at all of the sort of the data and try to bring it together? What are you, as a watcher, what do you watch, and then what should we watch?
I would say that the sum of it and the combination of what we see is the most effectful and impressive, and you can say worrying one. You could point to certain ones, but I think I would see it as a whole. And then also all of my scientists will feel that I look after them, so that's very polite of me.
No data favorite, son or daughter there. Is there any one particular country among the Arctic nations that you believe will be more impacted in the near term because of the changes that we're seeing? And I'll take that out. Is there a non-Arctic state? Bangladesh was highlighted, obviously, in the sea level rise. But are there any non-Arctic particular countries that you watch for worrying signs of the global impact of the changes that we're seeing in the Arctic? So
the non-Arctic
and the Arctic. So is there a particular Arctic country that will be most impacted near term? All will be impacted, but near term, and a non-Arctic state.
Yeah. Well, we have in a way a blood vein. Do you say that? A blood vein? So,
blood wheel.
No, aura. Vein?
A vein.
A vein of energy flowing up the Atlantic. Main artery, yeah. If you look at the energy fluxes, the North Atlantic is bringing the most energy from lower latitudes into the Arctic. So the changes in near future is reasons to believe that countries like Norway, Iceland, Greenland will see the most rapid changes because of that kind of connection through the Atlantic, both in the ocean and in the atmosphere. When it comes to the non-Arctic states, I wouldn't point to anyone. I would point to the Northern Hemisphere. That could be US or it could be Asia, China, Mediterranean, Europe. So
are there any other questions? This is your time to ask a knowledgeable climate change expert. We've run dry with questions. Jan Gunnar, thank you so much. You always help me at a scientific level bring it down and help me understand what's important. Clearly the changes are profound. Clearly the impact is global. And we thank you for making a mad dash from the Oceans Conference, taking a break and being with us. And I'd ask you to join me in thanking Jan Gunnar Winter for an excellent presentation. We welcome you back. CSIS will be hosting a lot of future Arctic-related events, so we hope to see you in the future. Thank you, and stay cool out there. Think some Arctic thoughts as you head out. Thanks.